and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. On today's show, we're asking, how do you run an independent cinema? 5 years ago, we thought we lived in the age of the multiplex, but ever noticed how everyone these days seems to have seen everything already online? Gross, isn't it? If you're wondering, the independent one might well be the one that you actually like going to. We'll wonder how easy it is to run an independent cinema where you play what you want and hope that the audience thinks the same. We'll speak to the boss of the Rio Cinema in Dalston here in London, a local favourite.
His end vision was that people would sit in a cinema and see it on a big screen. It wasn't that people would watch it on their iPhone. That's not what cinema's heart is about.
We'll be in New York City to meet the peeps behind the new Metrograph cinema. Would you be mad to set up a new picture house in a rent-crazy big city? And we'll be in Bangkok, once the home to 100 beautiful independent cinemas, now the mall capital of the world with its attendant screens. Who is hanging on? That's all to come on today's episode of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Stay tuned. First of all, on our little trip to answer the question, how do you run an independent cinema, we're going all the way to Dalston, East London. Now, I've rarely seen Dalston in the daylight. Why? Because I love being in the romantic dark of the Rio Cinema, of course. The Rio is one of London's most famous and beloved of independent cinemas. It's on a high street, it's unassuming yet beautiful in a historical way, it's always got good films on, and like the Budgie, it's cheap. And yet, it's always under the thumb, it seems, from what people call commercial pressures. We went to see boss man Oliver Meek to tell us how he runs the Rio.
This part of Hackney was, 100 years ago, essentially a slum. It was very, very down at hill, very poor, and big cinemas like the Rio, you know, this would hold 1,800 people, and people would come here on a Saturday afternoon en masse to watch films, people who had no heating at home or no televisions, and this was their living room. So the you know, the sense of affection that that develops in a community is huge. And yeah, it is, you know, it's a listed building, and we still have a lot of these lovely original features as well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place, it really is. It's gorgeous, and it's, yeah, the fixtures and fittings hark back to a halcyon age. Yeah. You don't want to mess with too much of this stuff.
No, definitely. I want to always retain the character of the building. That's so important. So we'll start with the basement. And the basement is kind of close to my heart at the moment because I'm working on turning this into a second screen. So preempting something that we might talk about later, like how do you sustain an independent cinema? Well,
It's having more than one thing on the go at any one time, I guess.
The answer to that effectively is that you don't, unless you have more than one screen. And that's why there are very few single screen cinemas left in London, or indeed, you know, in Europe, because it's very, very difficult with just one screen to make any money. When I started here a year ago, I looked at this and I thought, well, it's big enough for a screen. So the plan is, and I'm going to start fundraising for this next month, is we'll need to raise probably £150,000 to £200,000 to transform the Rio.
Now that doesn't sound like a lot to get. Is that to get the whole screen and all the audio visual kit, or just to do that?
Down here, I think we're going to be looking at about £100,000 to turn this into a 40-seater cinema. And we're going to change our bar and cafe upstairs, make it a bit more inviting during the day, give us a kind of daytime income for people who want to, you know, have coffee and cake and use Wi-Fi and that type of thing. But also to make it more of a community hub, because that's a really important thing for a cinema. It has to be a place where people want to come and meet as well, not just see films.
Well, let's take a wander up this little staircase and get into the circle and have a little bit of cinematic action, I think. That was nice. Our grand reveal was a bit of Aardman animations there.
Yes.
A dog doing an operation in an operating theatre. Not much language in that one, unfortunately.
But you could hear 400 children munching on popcorn.
And is there sort of like a golden number for the amount of seats? You know, say you have a big film like The Revenant, you know, your sort of Hollywood blockbuster. Is there a kind of magic number, 300 seats, for example, that always seems to work?
So I'm reliably informed by those that build new cinemas that the golden number is 175 seats.
Okay.
That's what they look for. But, I mean, there is a bonus having 400 seats when you have something like The Revenant on. We do have Saturday nights where we're full. We have 400 people. And actually, the atmosphere of watching a film with that many people is fantastic. So we're going to go through to the projection room now.
By the way, this sort of holding room, this antechamber, is pure cinema, isn't it? The reels of old films stacked up here, the cardboard boxes with all sorts of what have we got? Mrs. Doubtfire, Toy Story, Spy Kids 3D, various titles up here. This is presumably the old-fashioned film.
This is the inner sanctum. This is the kind of beating heart of any cinema. Yeah. And this is, of course, where our projectionists work, and nothing would happen without them. So it's a really important space. And we're, you know, lots of cinemas now don't have, because of the changes in technology, don't have, you know, proper projection rooms. So it's something we're still very proud of. And I'll show you inside in a moment the old 35mm projector and all the old reels. So let's go and have a look inside.
Sure.
Okay, come on in.
Oh, wow, yeah. We've got the whir, presumably, of the projector itself, of the air conditioning to cool it down.
Yeah,
we feel like we're in the heart of the belly of the beast here.
Yeah, they have to be kept very cool all the time because the lamps get very hot. And this is the old 35mm projector here.
You say it's an old projector. I guess it doesn't get much weather next to it, but it looks very new indeed. When was the last time? I mean, are these still being produced?
Do these have to be
serviced?
Films on 35mm from time to time, you know, once every couple of months. There aren't that many prints around on 35mm anymore because obviously once everything went digital, it's much cheaper and easier to get things to us that way. But yeah, we do still use it, and we do show classic films on Sunday afternoons and that type of thing, and sometimes that's the only print we can get hold of. And there are a kind of hardcore in our audience who love 35mm, are still the purists and think that's the way you should watch film.
Is this a space? I mean, independent cinema, are these the places that are done away with in the larger multiplexes where it's putting a hard disk in a hard drive or whatever it is and pressing play? Are these the sorts of rooms that are dying out, Oliver?
Absolutely, yeah. And you can see it's quite a small room, but I've been in cinemas that have screens around about this size. If you felt, you know, you open this out, people do have 22-seater cinemas. So particularly in London, where space is at such a premium, you know, the bigger chains will look at a building of this size and go, well, we could fit 6 screens in there and that's what we'll do.
And lose their 35mm sort of capability.
Yeah, because actually now you can get projectors which are half the size, which will just sit mounted in a box and are all operated by a laptop. In fact, you can operate a projector now on your iPhone, you know, if you've got the right technology.
But it doesn't have the romance and the kind of weirdly familiar smell of the projection room, right? There's something about hot machinery, perhaps the idea of hot film, maybe not being projected right now, but it sort of lingers in the air and in the dust in here, doesn't it? You've been in the cinema business for a while. Rooms like this must be one of the reasons why you do it in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, there's an incredible kind of romance around this. And actually, any time I take anyone for a tour of the Rio, and it's an incredible building with all these kind of nooks and crannies, but it's when they come in here and, you know, this really feels timeless.
Ow. Okay, well, here we are on the, after negotiating the staircase over here, we are up on the roof. It's a cinematic view. It's a panoramic view.
It's a panoramic view of that. You can see the city and hive of activity over there. But you can also get a sense of just how huge the Rio is as a building. As I was saying before, bearing in mind that it was originally the Kingston Empire, like 1,800 seats that would have been packed out at weekends. Between Shoreditch and Stoke Newington, at one point there would have been 8-9 cinemas. I mean, Ephes, the old snooker club there, that was a cinema, and there's a huge mosque down there in Haggerston that was a cinema. And, you know, Hackney in particular had just dozens of these picture palaces that would have been packed. But as time went on and technology changed, there were fewer and fewer, and we're the last one digging our heels in at the end.
And there are all sorts of, you know, as we kind of take a wide look over London, we see, you know, increasing amount of satellite dishes and all the things, I suppose, that are a challenge to the primacy of the cinema, are they, and people's internet connections. Do you have to study into what are your challenges, or do you have to just do what you do, you know, better and better?
Yeah, I think that's right. We have to do what we do better and better. And you know, there is always an audience for film, and you know, the changes in technology have had a huge effect on audience numbers. But as far as I'm concerned, directors who go and make films, like, for example, you know, when Martin Scorsese went to make Raging Bull and spent, you know, 6 years of his life and all those hours and all those, you know, millions of dollars to develop that film, his envision that was that people would sit in a cinema and see it on a big screen. It wasn't that people would watch it on their iPhone. That's not what cinema's heart is about. Now, of course, that's the way that some people choose to watch films, and that's up to them. But I'm very much a purist in that way, and I think lots of people are too. And, you know, who wants to sit and watch Star Wars on their phone? Come and watch it in a cinema like this. Let's pop our heads inside
okay.
here. And it's dark and quite spooky, but you will be able to see this is the shell of the original Kingsland Empire that was built in 1915. Now, at some point later down the line, around the 30s, when talking movies came in, the cinema was too big acoustically for the sound to get to the top, so they kind of boxed it in for the acoustics. So this is very much as it was in 1915. You can see the original plasterwork, the original proscenium arch, but it's very dark in here.
Oh, wow, this is proper Bats in the Belfry stuff.
So be careful.
Incredible. I mean, this is when you see a sort of sense of the amazing industry, all the different jobs that have been involved in it as well. As you say, people do yeah. like the gas lights, you'd have had, what, cigarette girls. But yeah, this gives an amazing sense of just how high and mighty this place was as well.
Also, the role of the cinema manager back then was much more kind of theatrical. They were like a local personality. They'd appear before the films, you know, flamboyantly dressed and introduce everything. And of course, you'd have the person playing the organ. And
the organist entertains and the whole thing.
Yeah, coming up through the floor. And there would have been much more of a sense of theatre about it.
We'll leave the bats to sleep, yeah. shall we, and wander back downstairs. Well, thanks for your tour of the Rio Oliver. We're in the sort of inner sanctum now, the relative quiet of your office. Yeah. Talk us through how you feel that your job here as the boss of an independent cinema is different to working up the road at the View in Angel, for example. I mean, what are the attendant differences that you have in your day that they might not?
Well, primarily we're a charity. So the approach is running this as a charity and making sure we're doing all the things we need to do on a day-to-day basis. More than that, you know, chains are all programmed and run centrally, whereas we do everything here in-house, which is a lot of work. But it's great because you do feel that you have complete control. So everything from the film we're showing to the brand of beer we sell behind the bar is what we want to sell, what we choose. And if we want to change our minds about things, we can. We're not tied in the same way. On the other end of the scale, we don't benefit from those economies of scale that the bigger chains have, and it's very hard to compete with them on that level. So we rely on people's kind of love and loyalty for an old independent like this to keep us going.
And the films themselves, you know, it's a small operation here. It's a streamlined operation, as you said, Oliver. Are you programmer as well? Are you choosing the films and are you speaking to the distributors? How does that side of things work?
So we have a programmer here, Peter, who's also our chief projectionist. But I work on the programme too. So the way programming works is we're invited to go to screenings by exhibitors, which are typically anything from 2 months to 6 months before their release window. And then we work out the terms and we work out when the release dates are, and then we pick what we want to show. But there's also a lot more to it than that, because sometimes there are films we want to show, but we can't show them because there's another film we want to show coming out the week after.
The one screen thing.
Yeah. And, you know, with some films, we're contractually obliged to show them for 2 weeks. So if you want a big release, the distributor will say you can have it, but you have to show it for 2 weeks. But that week two of that film might coincide with the release of another big film that you want to show. So you have to pick between the two. And that's where it gets complicated.
How do films get delivered these days?
Most things are digital. So they're downloaded or they come as hard drives downloaded onto our server, but they are encrypted, obviously, downloads, and you get an activation code. So you'll download it onto your server, but you can't actually show the film until the date that it's released. After the date that you've booked it for passes, that encryption comes back again and you can't show the film.
We keep asking you about these 35mm films. We're obviously of a romantic bent here on the Culture Show. Why have they died out? Is that a matter of cost or size? Or
yeah, I mean, there's a couple of factors, but primarily they're very, very expensive to produce. So one of those, you know, those reels can cost £10,000-£20,000. And that's why traditionally, 10, 15 years ago, there was this thing of London cinemas getting films first, and then it would go to the outside of London afterwards, a few weeks later. And that was because they had a limited number of prints and because they were so expensive to produce. But since everything's gone digital, everyone gets everything at the same time. So in many ways, that's benefited the cinema industry as a whole.
And so that's when there would have been a bit of ceremony around the delivery of a reel, because they were fragile. They were expensive things to carry around and needed to be handled with care, I suppose.
Yeah, they're incredibly delicate and they do get damaged. And still now we show things on 35mm and the first thing we have to do is do a condition check to make sure that, you know, the film is not scarred and it's not going to break on the reel and, you know, disrupt the viewing experience.
In terms of ticket prices, I mean, that hoary old chestnut. Mm. You're very competitive, though, here. I mean, there must be discussions afoot to stick it up a quid or two. Or how does that work? At what point do you have to address that?
Well, unfortunately, I did have to put up ticket prices last year in October by £1, but we're still the cheapest cinema in the area and one of the cheapest cinemas in London. And we have cheap days on Monday where it's £6 a ticket or £4 for members. So that's as cheap as really you'll get anywhere in London. The Rio has struggled over the years. So from my perspective, there's no point making ticket prices higher. I want to make it affordable and I want to encourage audiences to come. But at the same time, one of the things that comes up a lot when people talk about cinema is how much more expensive cinema tickets have got. And one thing that people don't always kind of grasp and understand about that is that we don't take all of the money with cinema tickets. You know, the distributors take a share of the money, and that's anything from 25% to 65%. So really, we give a lot of that away, and there are huge overheads in running a building of this size and age too. So really, running a cinema, you make your money on the popcorn and on the drinks, and that's actually, you know, been the case since year dot, really.
That was Oliver Meek, director of the Rio Cinema in London's Dalston. After the break, we'll be investigating more indie cinemas in Manhattan and Bangkok. Stick around.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and today we're asking, how do you run an independent cinema? We're going to head to New York now for the opening of a brand new cinema in Manhattan called Metrograph. Founded and designed by fashion designer Alexander Olch, it harks back to movie theatre of the 1920s and has a pretty good programme of films to boot. We sent Monocle's Megan Billings down to meet Olch and to find out how you set up a brand new independent cinema.
I grew up on this island and fell in love with making movies in large part because of the places that I went to see them when I was little. Places like the Beekman, the Plaza, the Ziegfeld, which are now literally all gone. And one part of this idea was to try to reclaim some of that special glamour magic that I'd felt as a little boy going to those places, where even before the movie started, you could feel that something special happened inside. The other part of this idea is that this is a place you would really come to even if you weren't going to see a movie. And that is something I had not felt in the city, is to have a place with our bookstore, our candy store, two bars, restaurant, that this is a place where people are going to come open for breakfast and lunch and have meetings, write their screenplays, be a part of a movie experience that extends beyond the actual cinema rooms.
I was speaking to one of your colleagues a moment ago, and he said something very interesting, that part of this is reclaiming that magic of kind of going to the theater, what that used to be, that is in some ways lost now, but also kind of building something that's a way forward and what people want to experience when they do go to the cinema.
We've had remarkably stylish audiences and remarkably, frankly, romantic audiences. A lot of dates happening here, and that's a way that I've always thought about this project from the very beginning, was that this is a place that you can actually go on a date to the movies, which I felt was starting to slip away a little bit in New York City, that there is something special about coming to see a film, and there are the finer details of the chair you sit in, the decor of the room, but the overall feeling of the place, what it stands for, the kind of programming that we do, that it's something that feels special that you might just get a little dressed up to come to.
I would love to talk about actually those finer details. Everything is incredibly beautiful. As you said, the chairs have a wooden back. The fonts that you used are beautiful. You can peek into the screening room upstairs. You have a beautiful balcony. Every detail is really wonderful.
I mean, it's a strange project in the sense that I am a filmmaker and I've now designed a movie theater. So I've really approached this project, which has taken 6 years, really in the same way that I would a movie, which is the accumulation of massive amounts of detailed decisions from the chairs, which are made from the very same beams of the Domino Sugar Factory. So when they demoed the Domino Sugar Factory, we got our hands on the roof beams, and these chairs are hand milled into my own design. We're sitting in them right now in theater two. The velvet armrest, the velvet back, and the velvet seats combined with this old growth pine has a certain sense, I think, of glamour. At the same time, we're on a concrete floor, and there are some very honest details of being in a warehouse on Ludlow Street in Chinatown in Manhattan. And for me, a lot of the decisions here have been creating a world of contrast, of trying to have key items that speak of a certain glamour from an era that maybe is gone, and ideas that are very much now, that are sort of very simple. And so I guess you might call it a low-key glamour, sort of an honest glamour. So there's no real quotation marks here. It's not trying to be nostalgic just for the sake of nostalgia. It's simply trying to create a certain sense of formality and classiness about the space. One of the nice compliments I've heard is when people come in here, they say, I'm not even sure where I am. Am I still, you know, in Manhattan? I don't know where I am. And they're talking something about place. They're talking something about time. They're talking something about just the light in some ways, that there is a little bit of a transformation as you come into this space, that you really do feel like you've stepped into a slightly different world, hopefully a world that you want to hang out in for a while.
That was Alexander Olch, founder of the Metrograph Cinema in Manhattan, New York City. We advise you to get down there pronto. Finally, on today's edition of Culture, we travel to the megacity of Bangkok, home to some of the plushest multiplex cinemas in the world. Pre-film buffets and reclining armchairs are the norm at the city's copious VIP theatres. How then does an independent cinema survive in a society where the new and glitzy tend to trump the old? We sent reporter Preeti Jha to the beloved Scala in downtown Bangkok to discover how Southeast Asia's best preserved standalone cinema is holding its own.
I'm in the VIP lounge of a multiplex cinema on the top floor of a high-end Bangkok shopping mall. After my welcome drink, I'm shown the buffet that comes with my 700 baht ticket, equating to the cost of an average cinema seat in London. Now to recline with my aeroplane-style blanket as I extend my armchair into a bed. It's a short walk across a footbridge to the independent Scala Cinema, which is pretty unassuming from the outside. But just one step indoors transports you into a world where time has been suspended. The cinema seems virtually unchanged since its 1969 launch, from the imperial staircase that carries you past a five-tier chandelier to the cavernous lobby with ornate vaulted ceilings and a booth where paper tickets are still stamped by hand. Nanta Tansacha, the 70-year-old owner of the Scala, has clung on to the charmed past of the cinema built by her father. She's entirely unfazed by the gizmos of the multiplexes across the road.
For us, cinema is entertaining with the eyes and the story of the movies. We concentrate on movies. Of course, is it a chair? Maybe we are a little bit smaller than at the place because they have the blanket and everything. But no, I'm not agree that they just come and you just sleep here. No, you come to cinema.
Today, the Scala is showing Jane Got a Gun in its single screen auditorium that seats 1,000. But it regularly screens arthouse films alongside blockbusters at cut price rates. The Scala is one of the few independent cinemas still active in Thailand and attracts a loyal, if smaller, following than the big chains. They've always come to its defence whenever it's been threatened with closure by landlords eyeing more lucrative developments.
This is our baby, this is our house. I don't know in the future if they not allowed us to stay anymore. We try to save it, try to give it to the hands that will keep it. It's like this.
Thailand-based Philip Jablon thinks it's this passion for the business that has kept the Scala going, as well as its global fan club. I meet him there later to find out why he's been busy documenting these old independent cinemas.
The old standalone cinema is basically the living room of the community. People didn't just go to watch movies, they went to get their news there. They went to meet there. They went to, you know, catch air conditioning there, because there were some of the only places that had AC. So yes, culturally, these were very important places. They were true meeting places.
Philip is traveling the region to archive what remains of these weathered and mostly abandoned halls through his Southeast Asia movie theatre project. He then lobbies for the restoration of those with the best chance of revival. We travel to one such contender in the heart of historic Bangkok. The strikingly vast and all-wood Nang Leung Theatre was built in 1918 and is believed to be the region's oldest. It now stands empty and serene in the middle of a bustling community square.
The life cycle of this cinema was similar to the life cycle of a lot of cinemas. It fell into disrepair probably in the 60s and 70s, when newer cinemas were built throughout the city and this became kind of a second and third class cinema. I know by the 1970s and definitely by the 1980s, it had resorted to showing porno films. That happened in a lot of places in the world.
What would you like to see it reemerge as a fully functioning theatre that people in this community could go to once again?
It's got to be a mixed-use space. I don't think it would be able to survive solely on showing films. I've talked to many members of this community, and everyone seems to have positive sentiments about it returning to life.
Plans for the cinema's restoration are currently under consideration, and Philip's hopeful it will be back in action for its centenary in 2018. From Thailand's oldest cinema, I head to one just 11 years old to see why it's become a refuge for Bangkok's small but growing independent film scene. Nalit is a documentary TV host and perhaps an unsurprising regular at House RCA.
Only here that they screen this film, Hanak Miso Soup, only here. No commercial for half an hour, like in multiplex cinema. The atmosphere here is warm. I come here for a decade. It's like home.
Thailand's indie film scene is growing despite the limited screen time. But moviegoers like Nalit and his wife Patarasiri would love more spaces that celebrate it.
Independent movies give people in the city about creative thinking, inspiration. They give an idea about people around the world, how they live, how they think, and of course it's a kind of art. People here or any province in Thailand, we need a place of art.
For Monocle in Bangkok, I'm Preeti Chah.
Thanks, Preeti. So how do you run an independent cinema with passion, tons of hard work, there's a surprise, and an artistic eye on the bottom line and the bar takings? A cinema should be as independent as the people that come and watch the movies, each to their own. Where are we going to be hugging and a kissing in the back row of the movies? In an independent cinema, that's where. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was our very own Sundance, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bounden. Thank you very much for tuning in.